Museum is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting your participation in the final week of Jazz Threads, a community-wide jazz performance and education project with a free celebration concert at the Virginia Theater on May 2nd. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com or the Jazz Threads website at 40north.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for listening this afternoon. Before we get to our interview this afternoon, something I think you'll really enjoy, we need to take a little time here this afternoon to bring you an important message. We are now at the midpoint in our spring fund drive, and the money we raise in this drive helps pay for next year's programming here on AM 580. Please, if you haven't yet become a member of the Friends of WILL, now's the time. 217-244-9455. 244-9455. David Inge, the host of Focus 580, is in Pledge Central with me this afternoon. Hi, David.
How you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Okay. Usually at this time of day, I'd be home having lunch listening to you.
Oh, how about that? Well, let's talk about the business at hand.
All right.
Okay, it's New Member Day.
That's right. We know that there are people, very generous folks, who have supported this station for year after year after year, and we do not need to remind them how important their support is. They're always the ones that are the first ones to step up to say, what can I do to renew their membership, to increase it if they can. But the fact of the matter is that costs continue to go up all the time, and we cannot rely on that same number of people to pay the bills. So we're making a special pitch during this midpoint of our fund drive to people who have never supported the station before, or perhaps people who at some time in the past did, and for whatever reason, they fell away. We call these people new friends, whether you are truly new or you're lapsed. We're hoping that by the time we finish this week of fundraising activity, we will get that number to 500. We'll have 500 new friends. And right now, we had so far for both AM and FM, 201. So that's pretty good progress. That's not bad for being halfway through. But we would certainly like to hear from more new people who haven't supported us in the past.
So if you've never made a contribution or it's been a while, today's your day. Give us a call, make a pledge. The basic annual membership is $40. David, that's 11 cents a day. I don't even know if you can get anything anywhere anymore on the parking meter for a dime. Can you get time on the parking meter?
I think for a dime, but you better have a dime because it won't take pennies.
Right.
I know that.
And it's just a couple of minutes, isn't it?
For a dime, well, I'll let you know later.
Okay.
For that much money, you're not going to get it. I think that's a good way to think about it. If you think about it, just for pennies a day, you can help to support this service that we know you value. So right now, go to the telephone, give us a call. We have volunteers generously giving their afternoon to take the call. 244-9455 is the number.
Great deal. 11 cents a day. We accept Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express. Be the next member of the Friends of WILL. 217-244-WILL. And for all of those who have joined us and who continue to support us, thank you very much. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. In this portion of the program today, we're going to take a look at the miracle workers beneath our feet, worms. These subterrestrials plow the soil, fight plant diseases, clean up pollution, and turn ordinary dirt into fertile land. Our guest is Amy Stewart. She's a gardener. She's also the garden columnist for North Coast Journal, a periodical published in Northern California. You may have seen her work in other publications, including Organic Gardening and Bird Watchers Digest. Amy Stewart is the author of The Earth Moved, on the remarkable achievements of earthworms. Listeners, I invite your questions about earthworms for Amy Stewart. You can join the discussion with a telephone call in the Champaign-Urbana area. The number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The Earth Moved is Amy Stewart's second book. She's also the author of From the Ground Up, The Story of a First Garden. Her new book on earthworms, The Earth Moved, is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. And if you're online, go to our website. Check it out, www.amystewart.com. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Amy, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Celeste, good morning, or good afternoon, that is.
Yeah, well, where you are, I guess it is morning still,
That's
isn't
right.
it? Yeah, out there on the West Coast. This afternoon, as we talk about earthworms or worms, what are we talking about?
Oh, I'm really talking about terrestrial soil-dwelling segmented worms. So all of these worms belong to the class oligochaete. In fact, that's where earthworm scientists get their name, oligochaetologist.
That's a mouthful. You did very well there.
Thank you. I've been practicing.
Oligochaetologist.
Oligochaetologist. You've got it.
Now, because we've named other things worms that really aren't worms.
That's true. Yeah. Pet worms, flat worms, round worms. A lot of those tend to be caterpillars or grubs
right.
that are eventually going to hatch into something else.
Yeah.
The other thing that gets confused for worms a lot is nematodes, which are, for the most part, invisible. They're microscopic. You know, you can't see them with the naked eye. But when you hear about worms surviving the space shuttle tragedy, or when you hear about a study of worms and inebriation, they're almost always talking about a nematode called C. elegans that... It's sort of like the fruit fly of the nematode world.
Yeah, and here in this part of the country, we're familiar with that as we have a lot of agricultural interests in this part of the country. And
sure.
Those nematodes can do a lot of damage to corn.
That's true. They can do damage. But then again, they're just like earthworms. You know, there are other species that can do good as well and that can really shift the population in the soil to be more beneficial.
Mm.
And that's what really interested me about earthworms is the way in which they live in such a crowded world underground.
Yeah.
You know, I just hadn't really thought about the fact that a handful of soil could have a billion living creatures in it.
Yeah.
And earthworms are just the giants in that world.
How many earthworms do you think might be living in your backyard?
In my own backyard? Well, you know, I did a worm census one day. I just went outside and dug up a bucket of soil and counted the worms and kind of did the math and figured out that if all the soil in my garden was as rich as that one little patch where I'd been digging, I could have 650,000 earthworms in my little city lot.
Wow.
Which is a pretty extraordinary thought.
Very impressive. Within the soil, where are they most numerous?
Well, earthworm scientists kind of categorize earthworms according to function. So there's a whole class of earthworms that you'll only find very near the surface. They'll be under the pile of rotting leaves or anywhere close to the surface where there's actively decaying organic matter. And a good example of that is the red wiggler. That's a worm that's kind of familiar to people as a bait worm, and it's also the best worm to use for composting kitchen scraps.
Yeah, you have a lot of those folks in here.
I do.
Folks, critters.
I probably have 10 or 20,000 of them living on my porch. Most of those are at home right now. I do have some of them with me on the road. I travel with worms when I go around and talk about the book.
Wow.
But there are other worms that will burrow quite deeply. You know, the night crawler, which I know you're very familiar with in your part of the country, can burrow down 6 feet or more, building permanent tunnels in the soil.
When they come up at night.
And come up at night to pull leaves or other organic matter down into their burrows with them and hope that they manage to get back underground before the robins come along in the morning and start looking for them.
Yeah. How are worms similar? How are they different in other parts of the country, other parts of the world?
Well, you know, for the most part, most species of earthworms would look pretty similar to us, pretty similar to the naked eye. In fact, when I dig up species of worms in my own backyard or some of the other places I've traveled to look at earthworms, I send them to an earthworm taxonomist to be identified so that I'm sure that I know what I'm talking about. And it's not very easy to distinguish among them for us. But there are some large and extraordinary earthworms all around the world. Oregon and Washington State has a giant worm that's 2 to 3 feet long. Lily white And speaking of lilies, it excretes a fluid, a mucus, that smells like lilies whenever it's under stress. So there are some extraordinary worms. There's a giant worm in Australia that can grow to over 10 feet long. There's even a tourist attraction devoted to it. I think it's the only worm-themed roadside tourist spot that I found out about as I was working on the book.
Wow. You know, as a gardener, I'm a piker big time, really. Nevertheless, I really like being out there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have marveled at the worm, but I haven't given it a great deal of thought until the earth moved came along. And, you know, I'm wondering how it was that you decided to move from, you know, marveling as a gardener to researching and writing about the earthworm.
Well, a couple of things happened. I moved from Santa Cruz, California, which is right about in the center part of the coast, up far north, almost all the way to Oregon. And when I moved, I noticed that there were different worms in the soil. I noticed a little gray worm that I'd never seen before. I noticed that I had night crawlers, which I didn't have in Santa Cruz. And it got me wondering about how many different species of earthworms there were in the world. And when I realized that there are, you know, 4,500 species of worms that we know about and many more that we don't, I just thought, well, there's more to this story. And when I went to try to find out more, I couldn't find a book that was really readily accessible that would just give me kind of their natural history and the larger picture of earthworms in the world. So like many writers, I just had to write it myself.
Yeah, right, right. Along the way, you discovered a wonderful book, though, by Charles Darwin.
Oh, yeah.
On worms. And the title is wonderful, The Formation of Vegetable Mold Through the Action of Worms, with observations on their habits.
Yeah, I know. I think the observations on their habits is really the best part of the book. Charles Darwin wrote this book at the very end of his life. So this was 1881. He died in 1882. He was not feeling well. He was getting along in years, and he just couldn't travel the way he used to. So he really just looked at his own backyard, and it's amazing that he was able to do new science, you know, right there at home. And the question he was trying to answer was, are earthworms responsible for soil? And by soil, he really meant that crumbly black layer on the surface that in his days was referred to as vegetable mold. That's how the title of the book came about.
And today we would call that castings. Would that be correct?
Right. We would call it earthworm casting. Some gardeners might use a term like humus just to talk about that rich upper layer of soil that's so full of decaying organic matter. So that's what he was curious about. And, you know, he really did come to the conclusion that most of the earth beneath his feet had been digested by and will pass many more times through the intestines of earthworms, which is, he made far greater claims for earthworms than anyone ever had before.
Yeah, and how important was his work?
Oh, Charles Darwin, believe it or not, he's like the father of earthworm science. I mean, among earthworm people, he's known for you know, this work above all else. You know, and another funny thing about that is that when he died, his earthworm book was so popular that I imagine that he must have thought that he would really be remembered for it because it was selling so well, because it's such a readable book. But he was the first one to do such basic work as testing earthworms for sight, for hearing, even testing them somewhat for intelligence, really looking at their behavior and seeing, do they know how to make choices? Do they know how to make decisions? How do they go about handling the material that comes to them? And are they able to figure out how to grasp onto something? He cut out little paper triangles and set them outside of worm burrows to see, could they figure out the way to grasp this the most efficiently to pull it into their burrow?
Yeah.
So you can just imagine him doing hundreds of these experiments.
Yeah, and he thought this was going to be a curious little book, but it did very well.
It did.
Yeah.
It did.
Well, I hope the same happens for you, Amy.
Me too.
You tell readers that Darwin recognized in a way that no scientist before him had that worms possessed an ability to bring about gradual geological changes over decades, even centuries.
That's true. Yeah. And that was really the key to Darwin's genius, is that he was able to look at changes over a long period of time. You know, you think about a river, you know, a trickle of water running through the desert becomes the Grand Canyon. You know, Darwin could think like that. And he applied that kind of thinking to earthworms. One of the things that was happening right around his home as he was working on this book is that some Roman ruins were being excavated. And he used to go out every day and watch the excavations, and he'd get down near the ground and he'd see earthworms bringing earth up to the surface and gradually, and of course I mean in very small quantities, burying what was around him. And he came to the conclusion that earthworms helped to bury Roman ruins and to preserve the past for historians.
I know. That's amazing.
It is.
Also, he came to the conclusion that these earthworms were doing some evaluation, doing some experimentation. They were making decisions.
Yeah.
That's pretty remarkable.
I know, and it was he really went on a limb with ideas like that. But, for instance, he had done some experiments to show that earthworms will move away from light. They don't have eyes, but they have special cells along the length of their body that will tell them if they're in the light. And so that's how they keep themselves buried and safe. But then one time he uncovered a pair of worms that were mating, and he noticed that even when exposed to light, they continued doing what they were doing. And he thought that that must mean that they're making some choices, which is right there, just, you know, a remarkable observation. And so many of his observations are still being looked into today by earthworm scientists. There are a great deal of his work has been carried on now a century later.
Yeah. What did he report regarding the anatomy of worms?
He didn't do as much about anatomy, but his work kind of spurred a group of scientists in the early part of the next century and on into the 20s and 30s to look into earthworm anatomy more. An earthworm, as simple as it may sound, it's a remarkably interesting creature. Most earthworms, the nightcrawler is a good example of this. The nightcrawler has five pairs of hearts. So 10 hearts that are the simplest little structures you could imagine, but they line up on either side of the earthworm's body near the head. And while they don't have eyes, like I said, they have cells that let them know if they're near the light. No way to hear, but they don't have ears, but they can sense vibrations and move away from the sound of a bulldozer, for instance, or even footsteps. So they are remarkable creatures.
And tell us how they do what they do. How they do what they do in terms of digesting what's there, you know, making it work for them and helping the environment, for
right.
sure.
This is something I hadn't thought about before I started working on the book, but earthworms don't eat dirt. I mean, you think about what's in soil. Well, there's clay and sand particles, and there's water and air, and there's decaying organic matter like leaves that are slowly breaking down. And then there's living creatures, bacteria, fungi, protozoa, nematodes, little mites and springtails, little creatures that are so small that you can't see them with a magnifying glass, and many other that are microscopic. So what earthworms do, when they move through the soil, they ingest a little food, a little of the soil in front of them, and the clay and sand particles really just pass through their body undigested. But they're contributing the value of their digestive enzymes. And the other thing that they're doing is eating, as a food source, bacteria and other microscopic creatures. So some of those creatures pass through the gut of an earthworm and are digested during that process, but others flourish in the gut of a worm so that earthworms can shift the population of the microbes that live below ground. And most of all, earthworm castings are so rich in those microbes that they deposit them at the roots of plants, and then all the living creatures that live in earthworm castings can help plants to access the nutrients they need and also to transform nutrients into a form that's easier for plants to use. You know, like you think about calcium, people tell you if you're going to take a calcium supplement, take some vitamin D with it so your body will absorb it better.
Mm-hmm.
Plants have the same issue. There can be nutrients in the soil that are bound up in such a way that the plants can't just digest them well. So these microbes really help to make that easier for plants.
Yeah. How much humus, how many castings does a worm create in the course of, I don't know, a year?
That's a good question. And one of those odd little facts that has probably not been studied as well as it should be. I'm trying to think of what Darwin said. I think he talked about, he made some conservative estimates that I believe were an ounce of castings. Was it an ounce of castings a month? It's a small quantity, but what happens over time is that the population of earthworms, you know, there can be easily a million earthworms in an acre of soil. So that constant churning of the soil can really add up and be quite significant.
Yeah. He was really a meticulous, painstaking researcher.
He was.
To think about weighing, you know, castings.
Right.
What a thing.
I know. There are a lot of funny little very detailed charts and tables in his book where he recounts doing these experiments hundreds of times and recording the results.
Now, it was a popular success, this book. How was it received in the scientific community?
I think people laughed at him a little bit, really. He had a critic who said the first time he tried to talk about earthworms, he actually did a paper about earthworms in much earlier, 1830s, 1840s, and one of his critics said something like, "In the eyes of most men, the earthworm is a mere blind, dumb, senseless, and unpleasantly slimy annelid, but Mr. Darwin undertakes to rehabilitate his character." You know, and I think that I think he was being poked fun of a little bit, but mm-hmm. I don't think Darwin even saw that. I think his affection for the worms were so genuine that he wasn't deterred by his critics thinking that he was claiming a little too much for the lowly worm.
Yeah. Well, his life, his previous work before that book published in 1881 was pretty controversial as well. So I suppose at this point in his life, he could care less.
Oh, yeah, I think so. There's a great cartoon in Punch's Almanac that showed an earthworm slowly growing a tail and a head, you know, a more significant head and legs, and kind of turning into a lizard, and then somehow from the lizard gradually turning into a monkey, and then gradually turning into Charles Darwin. And the caption was, "Man is but a worm." So they were ready to make fun of him for whatever he did.
Yeah. Did his work in this area, in this study of worms, did it contribute to the field of soil science, which was right about beginning to emerge right about at that same time, I think?
Yeah, it did. You know, you're right. Right around that same time, we were beginning to just have the technology to be able to see soil microbes for the first time and to identify a bacterium as the cause of a plant disease. So what Darwin did is take a look at this other creature that lived in the soil and begin to realize that whatever it was doing in the soil, it was doing it at a far greater rate than anyone had imagined. Darwin estimated 50,000 earthworms in an acre of soil, roughly. And at the time, people thought that was insane. They couldn't imagine so many earthworms in an acre of soil. And it turns out that he was well on the low side. So what happened after that is that on into the 20s and 30s, we really started to look at earthworms in agriculture and start to understand a little bit better what they were doing with all that powerful digestion and really start to identify all the species around the world. You know, Linnaeus only identified one earthworm in his taxonomy, and that was Limbricus terrestris, the nightcrawler. So there was far more work to be done on that front.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Amy Stewart is our guest this afternoon. She's the author of The Earth Moved on the Remarkable Achievements of Earthworms. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon. Your questions about earthworms are invited. You can join us with a telephone call. In the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. It seems, Amy, today that even today the earthworm really doesn't get the kind of respect it deserves. Tell us about the people who are working in the field of earthworms.
Earthworm scientists, you know, that was really the fun part of this for me, was getting to go around and talk to people who are doing this work. But it's true that it's challenging to do for a few reasons. There aren't a lot of people doing the work, for one thing. I think that most of the earthworm scientists I talked to wish they had a few more young, willing graduate students who wanted to go into earthworm science. And the resources just aren't there. You know, most scientists today, unlike Charles Darwin, who was free to pursue whatever he wanted to. Any interest he had, he could pursue. But most scientists today have to sort of go from one grant to another in order to fund their research. But the nice thing is that they're so committed. You know, they're so genuine about their affection for earthworms. There's a taxonomist named John Reynolds who lives in Canada who I talked to, and John said that he really felt that earthworm scientists had missed an opportunity and that while ornithologists, for instance, had really been able to engage the public's imagination in bird watching and even benefit from the work of amateur bird watchers, that earthworm scientists had missed that opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And the public just has not become as enthralled with earthworms as they have with butterflies and beetles and hummingbirds and birds.
Yeah. Let's talk with some listeners. Now, first we're going to go to Clark County, and we have a listener there on the toll-free line, line 4. Hi.
Hello. I own farmland, and for a long time I've been concerned about the use of anhydrous ammonia and how it affects work that worms do. I wonder, can you address that question? I'll hang up and listen.
Okay, that sounds good. Yeah, actually, anhydrous ammonia is something that we do know can be harmful to earthworms. I don't think it's been well studied enough, but in general, and I'll address this both to farmers and to gardeners at home. For instance, gardeners at home will use use a high nitrogen fertilizer for their lawns, and those can be among the more harmful things for earthworms. And in general, also keep in mind that your question is a little bit broader than that, in that it's not just about what affects the earthworms, but what about all the other living creatures that live in the soil alongside earthworms and that earthworms rely upon as a food source? So I think it's an interesting question for farmers. And, you know, one of the other things that farmers, I think, are really starting to look at is tilling practices. It turns out that regular plowing of a field will very quickly run down your population of earthworms, and no-till agriculture has become something that farmers are looking into, and gardeners at home are maybe getting away from double digging a little bit and start looking at just piling organic matter on the surface of the soil, but leaving the soil undisturbed as a more intact soil community. So I think it does make us change how we think about growing food and gardening.
Yeah, you've ended your practice of double digging.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot less work, too, isn't it?
I'm doing a lot more. It's less work, and I just know that I'm leaving that soil system intact. You know, there are other microbes in the soil that don't like to be disturbed either. So I think I'm doing some good, and I'm just bringing in compost and mulch and piling it on the surface and planting right into that, and it works well for me.
Let's talk with another listener, caller on line 1 in Urbana. Hi.
Hello. Well, I just about answered my question. I had similar thoughts. I was going to, when I was a kid, the used to go through the fields, and the smell was different to the soil, and the birds would follow the tractors
mm-hmm.
to the field and come after the farms and things that were plowed up, and you don't see that anymore. And I was wondering if the insecticides and the different procedures were destroying that, and if we weren't, you know, cutting our nose up inside our face, sort of.
Right, yeah. I mean, I think you're raising a very valid point. And keep in mind that not every insecticide will have exactly the same harmful outcome for earthworms. But like you say, you know, I think over time the life in the soil has diminished. And I do think that we may be cutting off our nose to spite our face. I certainly think it's worth looking at alternatives that will help keep the soil alive. Once that resource is gone, I don't know how we're going to get it back.
Well, we built a house in St. Joseph, and when we did that about 11 years ago, it has taken this long before that soil is producing earthworms again.
Oh, really?
And also, the ground was very hard. There were no worms anywhere on the soil. There was no earthworms at all when we were first there, and it was disheartening. I just thought, well, what are our fields doing without the, if nothing else, the digging of tunnels to provide drainage for the soil? It was really, I wonder what our farmland's going to look like in 50 years.
Yeah. I think it's a valid concern. Somebody, I was just talking to a newspaper reporter the other day who said, you know, well, what's the balance? I mean, we do need to feed everyone in the world. So, you know, where is that balance where we say, well, we're going to have to rely on some chemicals, fertilizer and other agricultural chemicals in order to be able to feed everybody on the planet? And, you know, my response really was, well, I'm on a book tour right now, and I've been in some of the wealthiest communities in the country, if not the world. I've been in Marin, California, and in Carmel, and I'm not so sure that it's a lack of chemicals that's keeping us from feeding the world. You know, I think those resources are probably out there. And I'd love to see us, you know, just look at some alternatives and really, really stop and think about what we're doing, because you're right, that farmland's really precious, and we need to treat it as a resource and really think about conserving it.
I even felt guilty about taking farm ground and building a house on it, so I was, you know, contributing to the urban sprawl. So I was doing the same thing that I, you know, don't want others to do, and here I was doing it myself.
Well, farmers have to have a place to live.
It's very hard to try to adhere to some of these great, great principles. We ought to try, though. And if we don't have a good soil, it will grow anything anymore because of these creatures. We're not going to be able to feed the people then either.
Right, right. I mean, what have we got then? That's a good point.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next, we talk with another listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I don't know if you heard this, but prior to the millennium, at least one author was suggesting that if things really did go to pot, that we could eat earthworms.
Mm.
They said that if you can grow them quite easily in an old bird feeder, and they may not sound appetizing, but you know, if you're starving, they would. And I don't know if that they were being facetious or not.
Well, you know, any chicken will tell you that worms are a great source of protein.
Yeah, well, actually, I was kind of curious about fish and their attraction to worms. Do in a normal situation, do they get to, is there a natural source of worms for fish?
Not earthworms. I mean, earthworms are not a natural food source for fish. But I think the fact that they probably look like other prey and they move around on the hook a little makes them, you know, makes them attractive.
Okay. Yeah, I was curious about that, if maybe they went into ponds somehow or something. But anyway, the another question I had has to do with a article in the New York Times back in October last year.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you read it, but it was entitled... Researchers Build a Case for Earthworms' Slimy Reputation.
Yeah, about earthworms in the forest?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And they point out that all the earthworms died during the glacial intrusion into North America, and that now all the earthworms are invaders, so to speak, and about negative things about earthworms. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I went to Minnesota, actually, and I walked through the forest with some forest ecologists who were concerned about this problem. Now, glaciers didn't cover the entire United States during the last ice age, but certainly the northern areas. So a hardwood deciduous forest, particularly in a northern climate like yours and like in Minnesota, evolved without earthworms. And what that means is that there's a thick, spongy duff layer that builds up over years and decades on the forest floor, and that the native plants need that duff layer in order to germinate. So that includes understory plants and wildflowers and even baby trees. So what was happening in Minnesota is that people were coming down to the university and saying to the forestry department, you know, something's changing in our forest. Do you guys know what it is? And they kept saying, no, we really have no idea. And what they finally realized is that European earthworms had moved into the forest where no earthworms had been present before. And began to eat that spongy duff layer. Now remember, these earthworms did not act alone. They had us as their accomplice. We brought them into the forest either in fill dirt to build maybe a ranger station or a cabin. You put in a golf course near a forest and you're bringing in acres and acres of sod just in the roots of potted plants. There's a lot of ways that we help earthworms get around in the world. And in this particular environment, it turned out that those European species of earthworms were able to devour the entire leaf fall of the forest every year and completely change the composition of the forest floor so that native plants are having a much harder time getting established because it's just not their environment. So I think it's a good lesson to us. It really makes us stop and think about, you know, we would never bring a non-native plant into a forest like that, but we don't really stop and think about non-native soil and what might be living in it.
That's very interesting.
One last question.
I understand that like that other person that called mentioned that normal agriculture is pretty hard on earthworms. Could you talk a little bit more about that, and I'll hang up. Thank you.
Okay, sure. What else can I say about that? Well, I was just in Iowa a couple of weeks ago talking with Sam James, who's an earthworm taxonomist I interviewed for the book, and he lives right in the middle of farm country, and he came to a talk with me and got a lot of questions from farmers who seem to be concerned about earthworms. This seems to be a universal concern right now. I'm surprised at how many farmers I've heard from. And he said that in 1 year you could see a 25% reduction in earthworm populations by normal agricultural tillage. So I think that's why people are starting to think about no-till or reduced tillage and the use of cover crops and a few other agricultural practices that might help bring back earthworm populations.
Hmm. I wonder if, let me see if I can get this out, oligocatologists, thank you. I wonder if their stock is rising in colleges of agriculture.
Uh-huh.
You know, this could, if there's interest on the part of farmers.
Right.
I would think that, you know, John Reynolds might be in for a boom time.
That's right. I think that's where the research is headed. That's where we become very interested in earthworms is really where they benefit us in some way. So right now it's agriculture and it's use of earthworms for recycling and maybe even helping to address some pollution issues. And I do think those are kind of the next directions as we're looking ahead.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line one. Line one, are you there? We have a listener there? No? Okay, maybe they'll call back. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a few minutes left in this portion of the program. Our guest this afternoon, Amy Stewart. She is the author of The Earth Moved, on the remarkable achievements of earthworms. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Well, tell us about your worm bin.
My worm bin. You know, I have a stacking worm bin, and I really recommend these. They're a little bit more expensive, but I think they're well worth it. This is a bin that's, you can sort of picture this worm condo, right? It's these three stacking trays with holes in the bottom of each tray so the worms can move up and down through it. I live in a pretty mild climate, and my bin just stays outside on my porch. I know that a lot of people who live in a place where the winters are very cold might keep a worm bin in their garage or in their cellar or somewhere where it can be protected from the frost. But basically, the earthworms get all of my kitchen scraps. They get everything except like the meat and the dairy, anything with fat in it. And what they produce in exchange is their castings, which is something that I use in very small quantities. You know, a little goes a long way. So when I take a tray of castings out of my worm bin, as I do 4 or 5 times a year, I usually have enough for all the plants that I'm going to plant. You know, I can put in an entire vegetable garden and put a little scoop of castings at the bottom of each plant down in the roots where I know it'll kind of inoculate that area and really help support plant roots. So they're fun to have. You know, I think worms make a great pet. They're quiet and clean and well-behaved, and they actually contribute something to the household, which is more than I can say for my cats, for instance. They're nice. Yeah.
Well, there are other creatures in that worm bin as well. That's got to be interesting to watch as well.
It is true. And, you know, I always wonder, how do they know? How do they find their way in here? But you will find a lot of other creatures living in a worm bin, sow bugs or pill bugs. Sometimes called roly-poly bugs by kids. They're shredders, so they will show up in a compost bin and start shredding. There's a tiny little white, sort of a cousin to the earthworm called a pot worm. People always think they've got baby worms when they see these, but they're actually full-grown, just tiny little white worms that show up and do some of the same work that earthworms do. Springtails, which are very small white creatures. You can just barely see them. It looks like somebody's sprinkled a little flour or sugar into your worm bin when you see these springtails. But they're also there helping to digest and break down organic matter.
All that says you've got a healthy worm bin, I would
say.
That's
right. Yeah, it's all good. It's all a good sign.
Yeah. Well, speaking of baby worms, you've got red wigglers, right?
Mm-hmm.
How do worms reproduce, and what do their offspring look like off the, at the starting line, so to speak?
Well, most earthworms are hermaphrodites, which means that they're both male and female. And for the most part, those hermaphroditic species of worms reproduce sexually, meaning that it takes two of them. And they have pores on their undersides that are, for the most part, invisible to the naked eye. If you had a very large night crawler, you might be able to see some of these pairs of pores on the upper part of the worm's body underneath on its belly. So they line up so that their male and female pores kind of line up along their belly, and the worm that receives the sperm will take it. A cocoon will form around its body. You know that thickened band of lumpy flesh about a third of the way down an earthworm's body? That's called the clitellum, and a cocoon forms there. And the earthworm slides backwards out of this mucousy cocoon, and it seals shut on either end so that it's shaped kind of like a lemon with ends pinched closed on either end. And the sperm and the egg are in there so that fertilization happens later inside the cocoon, and out of the cocoon hatch baby earthworms. They don't go through a larval stage or anything else like that. So they actually hatch as fully formed earthworms, but tiny. I mean, I'll find them sometimes in my worm bin, and I'm afraid to handle them. They're so small and frail. But they're segmented and pink and look just like their parents.
Mm, very interesting.
Yeah.
We've used up the time, and it's flown by. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon. Fascinating subject and a great book, a really fun read. It's a page-turner.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm glad you like it.
And I wanna thank you very much for joining us this afternoon, Amy.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Take care now.
Okay, thank you.
Amy Stewart is the author of The Earth Moved on the Remarkable Achievements of Earthworms. The book is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn in Pledge Central with us this afternoon. David Inge, the host of Focus 580. Hi, David.
That's me. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
I'm okay. Yourself?
I'm fine. Thank you.
I was sitting here listening to this interview, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, there are some things that you will only hear on public radio. And then there are other things that even on public radio you're hardly going to hear. And I think this interview that you just did was a wonderful example of stuff that I think even only we are going to do.
Yeah, but isn't it interesting?
Oh, it's fascinating. It truly is. And I think that's one of the luxuries that we have in doing what we do, of being able to have this long, extended conversation about just about anything. We can always engage our own interest and curiosity and hope that when we do that, that there will be people in. And obviously, there always are people who are listening who at the end always say, man, that is really interesting. And I never knew that. And I never thought about that. And I think it's one of the ways that we're trying to open up to people subjects and things that they just never thought about before.
Yeah, yeah. I want to mention, too, that Amy Stewart has a website that's a lot of fun to look at, www.amystewart.com. And she's got a blog on there. And Harriet Williamson, our producer, David, was looking at the blog, and there's a lot of fun things on there, including this. Somebody threw out this bon mot, worms of endearment. Do you like it?
I like that a lot.
Okay.
Worms of endearment.
Well, let's get back to the business at hand.
Okay.
If you're out there listening, and who else are we talking to, right? If you're listening and if you value this kind of programming, if you enjoy the conversations that David and I have Monday through Friday with our guests here on the Afternoon Magazine and on Focus 580 in the morning, well, I hope that you will join us and become a member of the Friends of WILL. That's how we stay on the air. Support from listeners provides half of our funding, and so it's very important that if you haven't yet become a member of the Friends, or if it's been a while, that you join us with a contribution. The number to call, 217-244-9455. It's new member day, right?
That's right. We're hoping that by the end of the week, end of our spring fundraising effort, that we will hear from 500 new members, and it's very important that as time goes along, we increase the base of support for the station, because as we continue to say, costs go up all the time. And so we need to grow the organization, do that week by week, year by year. And we've actually this week been making good progress on our daily goals. We're hoping by the end of the day today that we will have reached at least $83,000. And the most recent pledge total that I have, this is now for both stations, it's $78,412. So we're doing very well, but we need to keep the phone ringing and need to have people continue to call, particularly if you are new, if you have not supported us or it's been a while, we'd really like to hear from you today.
And the basic membership is $40. That's an annual membership. It breaks down to a contribution of 11 cents a day. I think that's a pretty good deal. 217-244-9455. The money we raise in this drive helps pay for next year's programming here on AM 580. This is critical. The members of the Friends of WILL are the folks who keep AM 580 on the air. 217-244-9455. And to those who are members who have joined, thank you very much. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, and settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. We talk now with Todd Gleason. Hi, Todd.
Hi, Celeste. How are you this afternoon?
I'm fine. Thank you.
An excellent program, as usual. And by the way, if you were listening to Celeste's program and you thought it was good and you listen regularly to the Afternoon Magazine, don't forget to call in support of Celeste's program and all the things that are happening here at WILL at 217-244-9455. It's just the right thing to do. Speaking of the right thing to do, futures at the Chicago Board of Trade decided the right thing to do today were to go lower. And they did so sharply in both the beans and corn, if you want to call a 5-6 cent drop. Sharp for the corn, the wheat pit was down 12 today in the nearby May contract. It had a high of 391.5, a low at 382. A settlement price there, 12 cents lower at 385 for the day. July futures for the wheat, 401, the high, the low at 390.5. A settlement, 393.25. They were down 12.75. In September futures, 405.5, the high, the low at 397. Settled 399, down 12.5 cents. In December contract, 414, the high, the low at 405. Settlement price at 407.5, down 12.5. And the March contract, 415, the high, the low at 410. Settlement price, 412.5. They were down 12 on the day. May corn now, 306.5, the high, the low at 299.75. Settlement price, 304, down 5.25 on the day. July futures in the in the corn pit, 313, the high, the low at 304.75. A settlement price at 309, down 6 cents. September futures, 309.25, the high, the low at 301. Settled 305.5, 5.5 lower. December off 5.5 as well. That's your new crop, 305.75, the high, the low at 297.5. December futures settling 5.5 cents lower at 302. March contract, 308.5, the high, the low at $3.5. Settlement at 305, down 6 cents. In the May corn, 309, the high, the low at 303.5. A settlement at 307, down 5.5 cents. July futures, 310, the high, the low at 303.5. Settled 307.5, or rather 307 even, and they were down 5.5 in December for 2005. 276.5, the high, low at 273. A settlement price there at 274, 2 years out, 2.5 cents lower for the day. The May oats, 163, the high, the low at 159.25. In a settlement price at 161, they were down 2.25 for the day. And July futures, 169.25 high, low at 164.5, a settlement price at 166.75. They finished the day down 3. Soy complex down between 11 and 17.75 cents. We'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, about the drop today in the market. And Dave Dickey tells me that Paul has changed his tune just a bit, turning slightly bearish on this market. So we'll talk to him about that. And how that happened over the last week, I recall having a conversation with him on Wednesday on that big up day last week when he was feeling his oats just a bit. So we'll discuss just why that happened. May soybeans for the day, 949 the high, the low at 926, settlement price at 935. They were down 17.75 on the day. July soybeans, 945 the high, the low at 921, settled 933.5, 15.5 lower. In the August, 886 the high, the low at 868.5. Settled 877.5, 15.5 cents lower. September beans, 783 the high, the low at 768. Settled 774, down 15.5 cents. Now your November new crop, 728.75 the high, low at 710. They bounced pretty well off that low today, 721. 11 cents above the low, but they still settled 13.75 cents lower for the day. January soybeans, 727 the high, the low at 713. Settled 722, down 12. In the March beans, 720 the high, the low at 709. Settled 718, They finished 11 lower on the day. The May bean meal, 295.50. The high, the low at 290.10. Settled 294.50. That was down 280. July bean meal, 294. The high, the low at 288.20. Settled 292.80. Down 290. May bean oil, 31.98. The high, the low at 31.28. Settled 31.65. They were off 63. July off 63 as well in the bean oil pit at 31.75 on the high, the low at 30.85. And a settlement price 63 lower for the July bean oil at 31.35. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
A mixed day today, Todd, on the Mercantile Exchange. Lean hogs finished higher. Live cattle were lower, and April feeder cattle finished higher, but May and the May and August contracts were lower. April feeder cattle, 94.60, the high 94 even, the low 94.55, the settlement that up 22.5. May 93.10, the high 91.90, the low 92.15, the settlement that down 57.5. August 94.80, the high 93.60, the low 93.77.5, the settlement that down 45. April live cattle, 83.45, the high 82.27.5, the low 82.35, the settlement that down 82.5. June 78.20, the high 76.85, the low 76.92.5, the settlement that down 100. August 79.15, the high 78.20, the low, the settlement 78.37.5, that down 75. October live cattle 87.15, the high, the low 79.05, the settlement 79.07.5, that down 95. May lean hog 69.75, the high 68.45, the low 69.42.5, the settlement that up 77.5. June lean hog 71.65, the high 70.45, the low 70.62.5, the settlement that up 2.5. July lean hog 71.05, the high 69.75, the low 70.30, the settlement that up 20. August lean hog 68.60, the high 67.80, the low 68.25, the settlement that up 2.5. And May bellies 107.35, today's high, the low 105.70, finishing at 106.85, that up 90. The Dow down 3 points at 10,311. The NASDAQ is 12 higher at 1991. And the S&P 500 is up 6 points at 1124.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, imported foods from around the world, featuring a selection of international European cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, and more. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University Avenue in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Andrew Pooser from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho writes, Dear Dr. Science, three sailors walk into a hotel. The desk clerk charges them $30 for a room, $10 each. The bellboy takes their bags up, and when he returns, the desk clerk says that he mistakenly overcharged them and hands the boy five singles to take up to the sailors. Unable to figure out how to divide the five bills three ways, the bellboy pockets $2 and gives each sailor a dollar. So each of the sailors paid only $9 for the room, and the bellboy took only two. Where did the missing dollar go?
I admit it. I was that bellboy. And yes, I took $3, not two. There. It's off my chest. I feel better now.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.